Want to know more about what your favorite ninjas have on their minds? Check out the American Ninja Warrior podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and it's a great listen for any Ninja Warrior fan.
Hey, Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris McShane. So when last recorded, we had hypothesized, Chris, that it might be the end of days for Mickey Callaway. And it turns out we were correct. Mickey was relieved of his duties last week by the Mets. And, I don't think it was really a surprise, nor do I think that I will be shedding any tears over Mickey Callaway anytime soon. But let's sort of rehash the events. Do you think that this was an expected move, slash do you think that this was the right move?
Okay, so definitely the right move. And last episode I said I gave it a 60-40 chance, that they would do it. in part because they're the Mets. I could see them making the wrong decision. So I said that, and then like 2 hours after we published it, they fired him. So, but even in that context, I guess I thought it was more likely than not. So certainly wasn't shocking news that they did it. And it's funny, as a fan, when it gets down to that point of, okay, the guy is actually getting fired, you kind of naturally can go back and question, like, well, wait, was it really that bad? Maybe have second thoughts. So even going through that process, to me, you get back to that conclusion of, remember all the games he watched. Remember the moves he made. Remember his explanations for things. And remember that he just wasn't good at that job. It doesn't mean that he doesn't know anything about baseball. It doesn't mean that he wasn't a good pitching coach in Cleveland. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have, I don't know if another managerial job will be out there for him at any point, but he's a guy who can be in the organization and provide something. But that role clearly wasn't a fit for him. The Mets made the right move. I don't want to say you couldn't get worse, because I'm sure you could. But given the reality of who's out there and everything else, I really don't think the Mets are going to downgrade a manager after getting rid of Callaway. So
it would take a lot to downgrade a manager.
Yeah. I remember asking the question, I think on the Amazing Avenue account, at some point after some ridiculous explanation that he gave, like, what is Mickey Callaway worse at, managing or talking about managing? And when you can legitimately have that thought, that's not a good thing, because as much as I think the New York sports beat can sort of hype itself up and talk about how difficult it is to play or manage in New York because of the number of outlets that cover the teams and all that stuff. And I think a lot of that's really overrated. I do think you have to account for that being part of a job, especially with a manager who is scheduled to do it every day, 162 times a year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that this is both the expected move and the right move. It's about time. I agree that it probably was the wrong move to do it during the season, because I don't think a managerial change could have changed the Mets lots in how the season was going to go. Unless they did it the day after the Vargas incident, that's the only time during the season I think it would have made sense for them. But they didn't do it then, and so they might as well wait till the end of the season. And this was fine, and They gave him the dignity, I suppose, of being able to collect a win and then go home and feel good about himself that night, instead of saying, instead of calling him into the office after the game and saying, you know, this is over. But it was what had to happen. And yeah, I think we can all point to two or three times when he did something that was so patently ridiculous you felt like you were in the Twilight Zone.
Right.
And I just hope that the next manager gives us fewer moments of that.
Yeah, and I think a good indicator on that is that I would say that Gary, Keith, and Ron, and the memory that comes to mind is specifically Gary. They're not homers. I think they do a good job of being objective. But in that effort, I think they tend to not overreact to things. And there were moves that Callaway made or didn't make that Gary would get incensed during a game as it's happening. And to me, that's just kind of like, I'm not saying that Gary Cohen should be making every decision about what happens in the dugout, but
right.
But he's watched decades of Mets baseball and plenty of other baseball along the way. He's an outside observer who's inside, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And just some of his reactions, and the ones that stand out to me were when Callaway would make a move and then not realize that somebody hadn't been announced into the game and then try to rationalize that after the game. Those things where it was just as they were happening, Gary is strongly questioning them in real time before you even see how it works out. And that to me, that's sort of a lasting memory. This is not the manager you want when things are on the line. And unless the Mets drastically change how they approach off seasons, this team will probably go into next season. They've got a lot of good pieces, but they're probably going to go into it with a projection of 86 to 89 wins. And that's a team that could end up exactly where they were this year. That's a team that could end up at 95. But if you're going to play that game of being just good enough to contend, you can't afford tactical mistakes during games.
I was talking with a friend of mine the other day, and I forget where I read this, but a couple years ago I read that the average manager only gains or loses something like 3 wins for a team. Does that sound accurate?
Sure, yeah. I know it's something that, like, the baseball community in general has struggled to quantify, but yeah, that sounds conventional.
Yeah,
based on everything that everybody knows.
I had heard that like 3 is an extreme swing in one direction or the other, right? So even on the best of scenarios, where you think if you had a bad manager who lost you 3 games in the season, and then you went to a great manager who won you 3 games the season, you have a 6-win sweep, a swoop, right, from low to high. I don't know if the Mets, whoever they manage, are going to get 6 wins out of the manager's chair for a season. But I think that the 2 things that will definitely be improved upon without Callaway will be some sort of responsibility for his decisions, whoever the manager is. Just, you know, there's nothing wrong with the manager saying, I went with my gut and it was the wrong thing to do. Absolutely, yeah. Nothing wrong with that. And he never once said that.
Yeah, no. In times like these, it's kind of refreshing if somebody can admit that they made a mistake.
Absolutely.
And they're going to try to improve on it. And he just never would do that. I don't know that every other candidate out there would, who could be the next manager of the team, but it was just not in his vocabulary to say, hey, I did that. Could have gone better. I could have made a better decision, and I'm going to learn from it.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason that was so disappointing with him was that he he had this approach when he was when he was hired, of sounding like, oh, he's young for a manager. His press conferences were refreshing. I don't know. I'm not saying after every game say, oh yeah, I really sucked. But when there's an egregiously bad move, or if something just blew up, I thought one thing that Terry Collins was really good at was trying to take the heat. And I didn't think, and I know Collins didn't do that every single time, but overall, I thought he would be much more likely to do that. And I don't think Callaway threw players under the bus specifically too frequently, although it did happen at times. But yeah, just a little more, somebody a little more humble, somebody who can say, here's the reason I did this. Here's the reason I made this mistake. And you know what? I'm going to do better next time, and we're going to do better next time. Even once or twice over the course of 2 years, it would have been nice to hear that.
Yeah. The other thing that I think a new manager will improve upon is just the – and I'm trying to phrase this in a way that will make sense. It's not just the accountability. It's that there will be, I hope, a clearer process that we can follow as fans. I'm not saying the manager has to give away all of his moves, right? You know, there has to be some sort of secrecy to what a manager does, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it just seems to me like Callaway would do things that you couldn't necessarily follow the plot to see how he got there. And if you're going to be so surprising with your moves, the moves have to work. Right, if you do something brash and radical and it's a success, great, people are happy. But if you're doing things brash and radical one day and then super conservative the next day and then insisting on bunting the next day, and then, you know, it just felt like there was never a clear pattern as to what he thought was the right thing to do in a situation. He didn't have a two-strike approach for his hitters. He didn't have an approach with his pitchers when it came to bunts. He didn't have just there wasn't any consistency there.
Yeah.
And I would really like whoever's the next manager to have some sort of consistency with their team.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Even if it's frustrating consistency.
Right. Well, yeah, where you at least feel like it's not, I don't know, spinning a wheel.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming up with a decision.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the managerial candidates that are out there. We had a piece go up on Amazing Avenue this week by Dave talking about the various names that have been thrown out there. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna use his categories here, and then I'm gonna ask you if one guy stands out to you from that category. Does that sound like a good plan to go with here?
Sure, yeah.
All right, so
I've got the list.
Okay, of the big names, we have Joe Girardi, Clint Hurdle, Joe Maddon, Buck Showalter, Dusty Baker, and Mike Matheny. I have two in of that list. I have two I definitely don't want. Two I would be okay with, and then two I have no real opinion on.
Yeah.
How do they break down for you? Who are the guys you're excited about from that list?
Well, Matheny and Maddon I don't want. I don't know if those are the same two.
Matheny and Baker I don't want.
Okay. Yeah, Baker has been an interesting case where I felt like he was mocked for a long time by like the smart baseball internet, and then all of a sudden everybody was totally in love with him.
Yeah.
I think the reality is probably somewhere in between those two things. But yeah, he's still not as off-putting. Matheny, with the way things ended with the Cardinals, like, no thanks. Maddon, I think he's kind of run his course. the way he approached certain things in Chicago, whether it was Addison Russell or just strictly the managerial side, regardless of anything else about the players he was managing. So yeah, those two, not so much. And then Baker and Showalter, maybe. Hurdle, I guess I'm indifferent on. And then Girardi, I know he's the big name of all of them. I mean, I guess if you just assume that Maddon is going to end up with the Angels, then that kind of doesn't even put him in this mix. So Girardi seems like the big name. He managed the Yankees for almost a decade. He still lives around here. He won a World Series as a manager. You know, he's got his credentials, but I honestly don't know what to make of him as a manager, because I've talked to people who love baseball and watch a lot of it, and the range of opinions on him is literally from the best manager there is to the worst manager in all of baseball. And I didn't pay close enough attention to the Yankees over the time that he managed them. I wasn't watching them every night. I know some of the things that he was known for, but I don't have a strong opinion on him yet myself. But I think it's sort of interesting that that people could come away from watching him and have those very, very different opinions.
So I had reached out on Sunday. I ran into a friend of mine who was a big Yankee fan, and I asked him his thoughts on Girardi as manager. And I meant to text my friend Anthony. Anthony, if you're listening, I'm sorry I didn't text you before the show. It's been a busy week. But my friend Michael told me that his two enduring memories of Girardi as a manager were not knowing when to pull his starters and letting his starters in, letting his starters just stay in way too long. And that's a bad thing for a manager, but that's not as bad as being Mickey Callaway with the bullpen. So, and I don't think the Mets starters are good enough that it may be okay to leave them in longer than you would for other teams. So if that's the big no-no, that's, you know, that's not the worst thing I've heard today about a manager. The other thing they said was that the last couple of years, when replay became something, that he was terrible about challenging for replays. He would challenge on the wrong things and not challenge on the wrong things. And I said, well, that's really more the video people's bad than his bad, I would say.
Yeah.
But I'd be okay with him, I think.
Oh, yeah, I think I would, too. Yeah. I would have my own opinion within a month, but
yes. And then the guy that kind of sort of confuses me a bit here is Clint Hurdle, because Pittsburgh's been such a nightmare the last season or two. But Clint Hurdle a couple of times has taken teams with much less talent than the Mets have to the playoffs. And sometimes that's luck, and sometimes that's, you know, just insert baseball euphemism here, whatever, you know. But I do think that there's something to be said for the success he's had with teams that aren't superstar teams. Like, you know, Joe Maddon taking that Cubs team to the World Series isn't that impressive.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I get it.
And so, you know, that intrigues me slightly. Dusty Baker just left a bad taste in my mouth. I watched too many games him manage against the Mets, and for whatever reason, he always bugged me. It's not really a scientific reason for not wanting him. I think Buck Showalter could be interesting, but I don't know if he's necessarily... First of all, I don't think the Wilpons will hire him, because I think he has a reputation for being his own man.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the problem. But also, I don't know... I don't know if he and Brody would necessarily be the best working together either. I get the impression they're very different people.
Yeah, I could see that. Not that, I mean, if I didn't see Girardi manage a ton, I certainly didn't see Showalter manage a ton with the Orioles, but from the reputations they have and the things that you do see, I think that's a pretty fair assessment.
Yeah.
Check out the American Ninja Warrior podcast for a behind-the-scenes look at all the action of the show and more with your favorite competitors. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
All right, let's move on to the next column here, which are the less experienced candidates. We got Joe Espada, who is the bench coach for the Astros currently. Luis Rojas, who is, I believe this year, the Binghamton Mets manager. Tony DeFrancesco, who is the Mets AAA manager. Any of those particularly exciting to you?
No, and not in a, they're not particularly unexciting either kind of way. So I don't mean any disrespect to anybody here, but nothing jumping off the page for me.
Joe Espada is somewhat interesting just because the Astros have been a very interesting team to watch the last few years, and they seem to be a team that does process very well. And so if they trust him to be the bench coach, that's probably a good sign. But I don't know if you – I watch or listen to probably 140 Mets games a year. I cannot tell you if Jim Riggleman was a good bench coach or not. You know, there's almost no way to judge that.
Yeah.
So I'm talking on my ass anything I say about Espada. And my only thought on Rojas or DeFrancesco is if they were that hot on those guys, they would have fired Callaway midseason and promoted one of them.
Yeah, that's true. That could have been the way to go.
Or kept Callaway for the start of the season, knowing as soon as he fucks up, one of these guys is taking over.
Yeah.
All right. We now have a category of three familiar faces. Joe McEwing, Manny Acta, and Robin Ventura. Please not Robin Ventura.
Yeah, totally agreed. Loved his time as a player, as a Met.
Absolutely.
But he oversaw the shit show of the White Sox clubhouse. They didn't win. They had the oh god, what was this, the kid's name? I don't want to insult the kid. The former national who was out there, Adam something, and his son.
Oh, I should know this.
They credited him for either Sale or somebody else referred to the kid as like a leader in the clubhouse after, after they
Adam
parted
LaRoche.
Ways. Yes, LaRoche. Yes, and it was Hunter or Duke or some name like that. LaRoche. Yeah. So yeah, no interest in that. And then Manny Acta, I feel like
Drake. Drake was the kid.
Oh, okay. I think Hunter and Duke was closer, but I think those are names that fit in with.
I think if you add Hunter and Duke together, you get Drake. So that works.
I'll take it. But but yeah, Manny Acta. I don't know. I it might be like managerial candidate fatigue, to borrow from prospect fatigue as a concept.
Sure.
Where it's just like, okay, he's been around maybe as a guy for the job for a long time and it just hasn't happened. And there's no reason for me to specifically hold anything against him. But I don't know, the years he has managed, it's not like he's done anything particularly great, but again, it's always hard to judge. It's so much more about the roster that you have and then using it correctly. If I guess in the effort to manage the same or to evaluate managers, the only way you could do it in like a scientific experiment sense would be to have every one of them manage the same roster over the course of the same season.
Right.
And see who came out on top. Obviously that's not physically possible.
Yet.
Yeah. you know what would be, this might be a galaxy brain idea. I'm pretty sure it is.
Well, let's see it. Come on.
Instead of interviews, have all the managers manage the same team against itself in like MLB The Show over the course of a season.
Yeah, give them each a PlayStation 4 and say, come back to us in a month.
Yeah, here you go. You're all using the same settings, the same rules, same roster. No gameplay. You're not controlling anything. You're not hitting buttons to make plays happen. It's just the simulation runs, and you are in charge of the team, and you can make decisions on who's in the game when and what the lineup is and all that stuff, and come back to us. And honestly, I feel like that might be better than the process that some teams use to find a manager.
I do not disagree with that. That is a good idea. I will also say I know nothing about Joe McEwen as a manager. I always loved him as a player. And sure, why not? Give him an interview.
Yeah. We're in sort of unknown. It's funny that the familiar faces are like the least known quantities, except Ventura, who's known.
All right. Last category here, the out-of-the-box possibilities. David Cone, Carlos Beltran, Edgardo Alfonso, Mark DeRosa, Al Leiter, John Franco, David Wright, Cliff Floyd, or any other former player, or Jessica Mendoza. Or Terry Collins. God help us, not Terry Collins. Love you, Terry, but we're good.
The obvious answer here for me is Beltran, because...
Same.
One, I think he'd actually be good. He's bilingual, and some of the other guys we've mentioned are too. So, to their credit, they are. But Beltran is. He is a very smart... he was a very smart player, and I think that showed in how easy he made it look to play the game. And I'm biased. There's still a Beltran jersey somewhere in my closet. I love the guy, and he was fantastic for the Mets. He's one of the best position players in Mets history. He's actually interested in managing to some extent right now. He's publicly acknowledged that he's open to doing it, whereas somebody like Keith is happy not to manage.
Right.
So, yeah. So all that stuff, all the positive qualities of him. I like the idea. This is just sort of like a romantic fan idea of rebuilding the relationship that the Wilpons shit all over when Beltran's time was up as a Met. And I like all that, but most importantly, and admittedly, this may not be as objective as my PlayStation strategy, but I just want the awful Mets fans who can't think of him as anything other than the guy who struck out against Adam Wainwright to lose their mind that he's managing their team now.
I can't wait for the hashtag blame Beltran to come back, unironically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll still be ironic, but...
Yeah, we will be ironic, yes, but other people will not be.
Right. I guess we'll have to figure out a way to differentiate if that comes to fruition. How? which hashtag blame Beltran is real, and which one is like, oh, wait, no, you know, we're clearly mocking you all.
Yeah. Well, like, I have some Yankee fan friends who they claim it's not them, but they know people who truly believe that Don Mattingly's presence on the Yankees makes them impossible to win a World Series. They will point to both the fact that, you know, the only droughts since he was a Yankee, it's the only like real droughts in Yankee championships come from when he was playing as a Yankee or he was on the coaching staff for the Yankees. And so I know some guys who basically were rooting very, very hard for him to be fired because they wanted the Yankees to go to the World Series again. which is just a crazy thing to say.
Yeah.
But there are people who probably feel that way about Beltran too.
Oh, I'm sure. And then with these other guys, Fonzie's great. He's been managing in the Mets minor league system. Cone, just from the way he talks about the game, he'd be very interesting to me. I think he's another sharp mind. And it's funny, public perception, it's not really fair, because if you're on TV all the time, and I know several of these people are on this part of the list, but if you're on TV all the time, we can kind of get an idea of what you think and how you approach the game and all that. And if you're not, then it's just like, yeah, I don't know. So they all stand out to me. I don't think there's another form of Met on the player side, you know, if we're just going on the tangent of any other former player who I think of and go, oh yeah, that's the guy. Like, I feel like the answer would be some, I don't know, mid-2000s catcher or something.
You could see Moises Alou managing, maybe.
Oh yeah. Yes. But he's been linked to one of the other open jobs, right?
Yeah, I think so. Let me just state for the record, I have zero interest in John Franco anywhere near the Mets. I cannot imagine John Franco being a very good manager for the Mets.
No. Based on how, in my personal experience, how do I put this? Well, he was in New Haven on a like rehab assignment, pitching some games for Binghamton. New Haven had a AA affiliate at the time. And his approach to signing autographs for kids at a minor league ballpark was not the one you would want to teach to anybody. so that's my only personal interaction, but
I'll never forget before the, I guess it was the 2010 opening day. I got off the, I had taken the LARR from Penn Station, and I got off the train and was walking down the boardwalk there, whatever it is. And I thought, that looks like John Franco standing there. And it was John Franco standing there just waiting for someone to recognize him. He was just like looking around waiting for someone to say, hey, that's John Franco. And then talk to him about being a former Met, and nobody was doing it. So, sorry, Johnny. Yeah, is there anybody else in that list that interests me? Let's see. Like you said, Cone's sort of analytical mind makes me not hate that idea, though. I think anytime anything goes wrong, you're going to hear people talk about what a scumbag he was when he was a young man.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep.
And I'm not saying that that is deserved or not deserved. I'm just saying we're going to be tired of hearing about it. Whenever he messes something up at the bullpen, the back pages will have some sort of allusion to when he pulled his dick out in the bullpen.
Yeah.
So I just don't want to have to deal with that for a year or two.
The 80s, man.
Exactly, yeah. Jessica Mendoza is a really interesting person to talk about, but it's not going to happen.
Right. Yeah, I
that's not me saying it shouldn't happen, by the way. I'm just saying it's not going to happen.
Right. No. I don't see that happening in this case. I think there's no reason it should be the case that's just like, oh yeah, that's just the way it is. Like, it's not about that. I think if there's going to be an instance of baseball team hires a woman to a very prominent position, it's going to be GM or president of baseball operations kind of thing first. And I'm not even saying it's right that that's the way that it would probably go down, but I think that would sort of set a new standard and open things up. But yeah, at this point in time with these Mets and everything else, I don't see it happening.
I concur. All right, well, before we get out of here, let's do sort of one thing we definitely want the manager to do slash possess, you know, in their repertoire. So it could be, you know, bullpen management. It could be press skills. It could be whatever you think is the most important thing, Chris. What's the one thing you want the next Mets manager to definitely possess?
I would just say a firm understanding of the basic concepts of all the statistical analysis of baseball that has changed the way that everybody's looked at the game over the last 15 to 20 years and using it properly. So I'm not saying this is the most important thing, but I feel like it could help define somebody. I don't want to hear about a hitter versus pitcher one-on-one splits. I guess I'll give the caveat that unless it's like 50 to 100 plate appearances that these guys have faced each other, but I don't want to hear a manager say that, oh, so-and-so's 3-for-5 against this pitcher and act like that means something statistically. So that's more like an indicator of it. But if a manager could just not do that, I would appreciate it. And then in game, I don't think you never feel a manager's impact more than when it comes to pitching decisions. So bullpen management. And I feel like one of the ways that Callaway kind of failed was, I don't know if he specifically said this, but he sort of set an expectation that I'm here, I've been a pitching coach, I'm young, I've got this optimistic, fresh outlook, and we're going to do everything we can to make the Mets this organization that deserves you, great fans, and all that, right? So he comes in with that approach. And you felt like, hey, this guy might really be on top of things and have a bullpen plan. And then things would just happen. I don't know if it's the chaos of a season. I don't know if anybody is capable of it. But if you can give us a real reason why things are going to happen, why you're going to make your decisions and why you think they're going to work, and then do that, and then you can rest on, hey, here's what we did that went into that. We know it didn't work in this instance, but we think it's going to work most of the time, as opposed to, and again, this could just be Mets specific chaos, but as opposed to, oh, by the way, Edwin Diaz has these rules about how we're going to use them that we didn't tell you about until a month and a half into the season, but they exist. And then a week from now, we're going to do something different and then tell you that they don't exist. Like, that can't be it. And I don't know if a manager alone can overcome that in the Mets organization. But, yeah. So I guess my actual answer is the bullpen. But please stop giving me, like, splits on a guy who's seen a pitcher in single-digit numbers of times.
Yes, agreed. I think for me, it's simply I want to see process. And that's what you talked about at the end there with, you know, just the team having a process that they stand by. I want somebody who's going to come in and say, listen, this is how we do things. It didn't work today. It'll probably work tomorrow. That's really important to me. So, and I think that's a simple request. Because even if you don't agree with the process, there's at least a thoughtful approach there. And we need a thoughtful approach. Absolute last question about this until next time we record. Do you think the Mets will have a manager in place by Halloween?
No. No, I mean, I could be wrong, but
what about Thanksgiving?
I think they'll have one in place by, Thanksgiving would be like sort of a pre-winter meeting deadline.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you're in free agency, you want to have that manager available to players that you're trying to sign and be part of conversations about the culture that they want to create with the Mets and, you know, things that, I mean, hey, they might know some of these players from managing past or coaching and in previous roles with other organizations. So, yeah, I think they will have it in place by Thanksgiving. Halloween, I don't know. If only because we know the Wilpons generally don't rock the boat with MLB too much, since MLB has not rocked the boat with the Wilpons.
Right.
Do you think it'll be a quicker process than I do, or?
I think it'll be quicker because I think the people aren't going to want the job as much.
Okay.
So the candidates are going to thin out quickly. Although, we should say this. We should say that Brody Van Wagenen said that Noah Syndergaard and Edwin Diaz will be on the team next year.
He did, yeah.
And so that will make it more appealing to a manager coming in. You know, I don't think anybody wants to take that job and then find out they don't have Syndergaard to play with for next year.
Right. And to Van Wagenen's credit, I would not advocate trading either of those pitchers, whether they had been their 2019 selves or better. So, yeah, that was good to hear. I know things can change and whatever, but it was nice to just say, hey, the offseason's starting. I know you're going to all ask me about this, so I'm just going to say it. These guys are on the roster. Might have been one of my favorite Van Wagenen moments so far.
Same.
Hey, I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, host of The Vergecast. We've been revamping The Vergecast more and more lately, and we're coming out with episodes twice a week, sometimes even a third bonus episode. On Tuesdays, I talk to influential people around the world of tech, like Microsoft founder Bill Gates and other tech execs like the founder of Lime Scooters, the CEO of Beyond Meat. We've also been talking to a lot of reporters and academics about the major pressing policy issues in tech, like Facebook's content moderation, they're not doing great, YouTube's harassment plan, or lack thereof, and whether or not the government should break up Amazon, which maybe it should. And then every Friday, I sit down with executive editor Dieter Bone and Paul Miller for our chat show. We cover the latest in tech news and product reviews. We bring in our other reporters from around The Verge. That show is a party. You should listen to it. You can hear all that and more if you subscribe to The Vergecast wherever you get your podcast. We'd love for you to listen and join us. So again, subscribe to The Vergecast wherever you get your podcast. We'll see you there.
This is Kara Swisher. I want to tell you about my podcast, Recode Decode. Every week, we have candid, in-depth conversations with people like Elon Musk, Nancy Pelosi, and Kathy Griffin. We talk about how they got to where they are today and how their work is changing our world. New episodes of Recode Decode are released every Monday and Wednesday, and we often have bonus episodes on Friday. Subscribe for free to be the first to hear them on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
All right, Chris. Well, by the time folks hear this, you will already be in California for the Desert Days Festival. So tell us, what is your music pick for this week, Mr. World Traveler to Music Events?
I guess that's true. I'm going to leave all the bands that are playing this festival to hopefully fill my album recommendations for like the rest of the winter. But somebody who played it last year and just played a residency in New York City that ended on Saturday night for five shows, Ty Segall, he is fantastic. He's prolific. I feel like on average he's had two albums come out a year. That may or may not be accurate, but it might be more even. But between various projects he does and then the albums that he puts out just as himself, he's pretty great. And he made a record called First Taste, and it came out in August, I think. And admittedly, I guess two things here. One, it didn't quite click with me right away, although there were things that I liked about it to start. And two, if you've never heard him, I don't know that this is the record I would say to start with.
Agreed. Yeah.
But part of the residency that he had done here, and he did one in LA that was more like a traditional residency where it was a weekly show for two or three months, and then came to New York and did it five nights in a row. But he played this record start to finish to start each night of these sets. And then played another record and then played an encore that had a couple things off of other albums. So anyway, First Taste, if you don't know him, he is very heavily a guitar player and a singer and a really good songwriter who can write like acoustic dreamy stuff that's really good. And then be heavy as anybody you've ever heard, and then just rip it up on the guitar. So with all that, this record doesn't have any guitars on it. It has stringed instruments that you can solo on and might resemble guitars, but technically there are no, there's bass guitar, but there's no acoustic or electric six string guitars on the record. And seeing him and his band perform this live, just completely. And I love when this happens, when now I can go to the studio record and go like, oh, hell yes. I get it now. So that show had that effect on me. Several times when we've done our music recommendations, I've given a like blind or one listen recommendation. If I love a band and I know they just put a record out, then I'll just recommend it. This one had to earn it a little bit more, but saw it live, bought the record at the end of the show. It's great. His wife does his merch. And is like super nice, and I don't know, I've never met him himself, but they just seem like they kind of get it, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, Ty Segall, first taste. And if it's your first taste of Ty Segall, maybe listen to Manipulator and Freedom's Goblin first and then go to First Taste. But trust me, there's a big payoff in this record if you just play it loud enough.
That's good advice for lots of things. Just play it loud enough.
Yeah.
So
yeah, when you blast something, sometimes you're like, oh yeah, that's how it's supposed to sound.
Yeah. So I'm actually gonna buck convention here, and I'm not gonna recommend an album, but I'm gonna recommend a live experience. I would presume that most of our listeners are in the New York metro area, or at least many of them are. If they are, they still have some time to go see David Byrne's American Utopia on Broadway. So Byrne had done this live show when his album, shockingly titled American Utopia, came out a couple years ago. And it was a really big hit, and he decided to put it on Broadway. I believe it's 16 weeks, and I believe we are in week 2 right now, maybe week 3. So there is still a fair amount of time to get there and see it. It is simply one of the most amazing live shows I've ever seen. The sort of conceit behind the show is he did not want anybody encumbered behind a drum kit or a keyboard, so everyone that's playing is mobile. So that means there's not one drummer, there's 5 or 6 percussionists all playing different things, but they're like marching band style percussions. They're walking around doing it. The keyboard player has like a harness on that has a keyboard around it, and everybody in the band sings, everybody dances to some degree, and it's super simple staging. It's just basically almost like a beaded curtain made of like chains, like chain links, and just white lights. And it's just sometimes the lights are brighter than others, and sometimes they're darker, sometimes they're focused on the background, and then they're focused on the foreground. It's a very, very simple presentation, but because everybody's moving all the time, and because there is so much choreography involved, it's a mesmerizing thing to watch. He does a really good mix of Talking Head stuff and stuff from his solo career. I mean, I think most of us would probably wish you would trade out some of those solo songs for more Talking Head songs, but, you know, I can't fault the guy for wanting to play his more recent catalog. Specifically, though, a couple of songs that stood out. Ezimbra, which is maybe my favorite Talking Head song, was just incredible to see. One of his solo songs from his, maybe it's 04 or 05 record called Grown Backwards. The first track on that is called Glass, Concrete, and Stone. That's a great song. He does that as part of the show. And he covered, I almost don't want to say much about it because it's so powerful. He covers a Janelle Monáe song as part of it. And yeah, it's fantastic. One of the most striking live performances I've ever seen was that song, but on a sort of bigger level, the whole show. Just really amazing. And, you know, I hate to be this guy, but when you're going to see bands and artists that aren't young people anymore, there's always the chance this is going to be the last time they're going to do a tour of this caliber, or that their health will allow them to do a tour of this caliber. And David Byrne is still an excellent voice and still a good guitar player and still putting on a hell of a show as a guy who's probably approaching his 70s now. And so take the opportunity, if you're in the New York area, go see the show. I can't imagine you being disappointed.
Well, I intend to take you up on that advice.
You really should. It's amazing.
Yeah, I still have not seen David Byrne perform at all.
Oh, man.
So seeing him in that context would be, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I would highly recommend. I am so enthused about this. I went with my cousin on Friday night. I'm almost thinking of trying to convince my wife to go again before it wraps up.
Nice.
So
that is pretty good.
Yeah, it's high praise coming from me. So, well, thanks for listening, everybody. As always, go to AmazingAvenue.com for all your mess-related needs. Our podcasts are sort of staggering some episodes now. We're not going to do all four shows every week, but you'll get at least two shows every week. This week you'll get From Complex to Queens, this show, and Unformidable. Next week you'll get From Complex to Queens and A Pod of Their Own. And, you know, we'll see what else pops up. I'm hoping to do a bunch more in-conversation shows now that the season's over and get some more players in the show, but we'll see how that goes. You can also find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Amazing Avenue. You can get this show from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever podcasts are found. This show is likely found as well. Please rate, review, and subscribe. I know last time I said we were going to do an email show, but then Calabay got fired, and we were trying to keep the show relatively brief tonight, although I think we kind of failed at that, but that's okay. So next time, aaaudiopodcast@gmail.com. Send us your questions, your comments, and we'll get to them on the show. And you can follow Chris on Twitter, at Chris McShane. I am at Brian Needs a Nap. And until next time, let's go Mets, and let's go Rays?
I'm the underdog factor there is good, but the Astros are the only team I trust to beat the teams I really hate, even though they're having a hard time knocking the Rays out. So I kind of selfishly want the Astros to win just to eliminate the Yankees and potentially the Braves or Nationals if necessary.
I could agree with that. So,
it would be embarrassing to all those teams that the Rays beat all of them. So
yes,
if the Rays do win, no question they are my team out of who's left. But yeah, I guess I'm rooting for the favorite just for myself.
Sure. So until next time, let's not go Rays and Nets.
Yes.